I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The author Andrew Piper joins me again. He's got a new book out, a terrifying one, The Demonologist. It's got a lot of buzz, and rightfully so. It's a compelling read. It's described as a major departure for Mr. Piper, who takes us into the horror genre. In the book, a Columbia professor named David Ullman has a scholarly knowledge of the demonic, namely Milton's Paradise Lost. As such, he travels to Venice to observe a mysterious phenomenon and sees his life soon cast on a journey of discovery. He's facing evil and demons, angels, and more. I'll get Mr. Piper to tell us about the book and how it's been received so far. Robert Zemeckis and the folks at Universal have optioned the book already. The best-selling and award-winning Andrew Piper has been on twice for his previous books, The Killing Circle and The Guardians. His other books include Kiss Me, Lost Girls, The Trade Mission, and The Wildfire Season. His website is at andrewpiper.com. The Demonologist is published by Simon & Schuster. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Andrew Piper. Mr. Piper, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
No, my pleasure.
As I said, and we've been reading this, if we've been reading up on you in the last couple of weeks or so, this is a departure for you from your previous books. Your previous books had sort of elements of ghosts, mystery, thriller aspects to it. What's the difference here in The Demonologist, and what in it plunges us into this horror genre?
Well, for me, and maybe readers would have a different answer to this, but you know, my feeling about, you know, horror versus you know, the previous books, as you mentioned, that are, you know, thrillers that might have a sprinkling or flavoring or interruptions of the paranormal, is the commitment that the book makes to creating a world. So, you know, The Demonologist, for me, is a, you know, a horror novel, or qualifies as a horror novel, as well as being just a general novel, because it builds a world wherein demons are real, and that that doesn't, though, mean that by world building, it's not that the novel, you know, takes you to the actual, you know, hell and pandemonium, and it's not fantastical in that sense. It's not otherworldly. It all happens in the present day in a world that looks and smells and feels just like the one we live in today, except one where, again, you know, the guy next to you on the bus might be a demon who knows more about you than you'd ever guess. And so it's the completeness of that world that I think makes it a more fully committed horror novel, whereas the previous ones, you know, again, had interruptions or intrusions or glimpses of the supernatural, but stayed this side of the line.
Well, what's the difference between a ghost and a demon? Is a demon, say, a bad guy?
I think demons, you know, it's a fascinating area of study, you know, whether one believes in these things being, you know, quote, real or not. But ghosts are the returned spirits of the dead. They are embodiments or partial presentations of those that have passed on, and they, for whatever reason and for whatever motivation, return to our world, and are typically beings that are not embodied. That is to say, they are shades. Whereas demons are real beings. I mean, they are, you know, we're taking a sort of a Christian biblical view of them. They've always been around. I mean, they are as old as God, and they predate humanity by a wide margin. And they are you know, in their earthly form, they are embodied beings who are neither, they're neither angel nor human, but something in between, and they influence human action. I mean, originally, again, sort of going back to, you know, the Old Testament, they are seen, Satan, small s, Satans, are seen as these beings who work for God basically as kind of testers of mankind. Mm. So Satan's job was to kind of put up barriers or basically kind of try to trip us up in order to provide data for God as to how we're getting along.
Yeah, or Santa Claus in that.
Yeah. Or Santa Claus, yeah. Santa Claus, yeah. You know, good, are you on the naughty or nice list? So exactly, they were kind of God's servants, and they were, you know, kind of sergeants at arms. And of course, the more contemporary, you know, modern version of demons are seen as more independent and strictly kind of mayhem making, you know, evil beings. And the demons in, you know, for me, in writing The Demonologist, I wanted to draw on all those traditions, but at the same time, create a new demonology, or at least a new kind of motivation for these beings that made sense in 2013.
Was this a challenge to write because it's a different book than you're accustomed to writing?
No, actually, it was kind of, you know, they're all tough in the sense that there's all sorts of places you can go wrong and all sorts of mistakes you can make. But this one, because it was, you know, sort of from the outset, so wider open conceptually, it was a lot more fun. In other words, every time I kind of came to a juncture where I, maybe in a previous book, I would think, I better pull back here because to go all the way would, you know, commit me to the reality of these supernatural things. You know, I wanted, you know, there was a certain restraint in the previous novels, conceptually speaking, whereas in this novel, it's like, no. There's constraints of good taste, and there's constraints of not being silly. And I didn't want the fantasy parts to be ridiculous. But there was no constraints in terms of the reality of, you know, the demons or these otherworldly beings. And they were allowed in. So once that was done, there was a great relief. I could have a lot of fun with it without just kind of peeking through a curtain.
Now, you dedicate the book to Maud. Who's she?
She's my daughter. She's 6 years old now, and, you know, so it's, you know, 4 or 5 years old over the course of writing the book.
Do you do her hair in the morning?
I do sometimes. When she lets me. Now she's quite hair obsessive. There's a world of difference between 5 and 6, at least with girls in my experience. So I will sometimes ask to... I love brushing her hair, but she only rarely lets me do it.
Yeah. You told the National Post, Mark Medley, about writing a scene in this book, and then... she coming to you the next morning, having had a bad dream, that sort of mirrored aspects of the scene that you were writing. She had no idea, obviously, what you'd written, nor anyone else in your house, for that matter. How much of this book does she know about?
Well, she knows it's dedicated to her, and she takes tremendous pride in it. She calls it her book. So she's claimed it for herself, and whenever she sees an edition, you know, now she'll sort of open it up and go right to her. She knows where her name is.
Yeah.
But she knows she asks constantly, but she knows I've allowed very little on the plot. I basically just told her the truth, which is, you know, it's about a father who loses his daughter and he has to go find her. And, you know, she's just simply too young to talk about, you know, the full extent of the story and, you know, what the father is up against. But it is strange, nevertheless, you know, that, as you mentioned, you know, that she, and at one occasion in particular, I don't know, I mean, she intuited, or she mentioned in very specific terms, i.e., you know, Daddy, what happened to the, why did the boy drown in the river? What happened to that boy? Which is very specific to a scene in the later part of the book where David Ullman, the protagonist's brother, is drowned. He drowns in a river. And we don't know for the course of the novel why. We presume it's an accident. And there's actually a much darker cause. And when she asked me that, I mean, I was dumbfounded. But there you go. I mean, whether it's some kind of, you know, demonic whispering or just kind of a father-daughter ESP, but quite strange.
Yeah, I'm assuming as the author of this book, there's a part of you in it, you know, since you've created the story and the characters. In the last book, you deal with the relationship that men have with their pals, friends that they grew up with. In this book, the relationship between the father and the daughter is fleshed out. Do you set out in a book to work something out about yourself and or go to, say, an extreme?
I think in this book, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the at its core, it is a sort of a father-daughter story. It's a horror story, yes, and it's meant to be frightening. Not necessarily in a you know, have you sort of weeping it, you know, yourself to sleep way, but in an unsettling, get under your skin way. But one that, you know, I think one of the downfalls too often of horror, generally, whether it's film or literature, is that there's very little emotional investment in the stories, you know, that at best they're often sort of visceral thrill rides and nothing more. And I wanted it to be that, but also to have emotional resonance for the reader. And for me, you know, when I first conceived of the story, it was just the protagonist up against this emerging world of the demonic that he discovers. And it didn't really, I didn't really care enough. You know, I didn't care whether he made it through or not, because I think indirectly I was thinking, I'm a father now. I don't really care about myself and my own welfare the same way I used to. I care about my kids more now, you know. Mm-hmm. When I'm sort of crossing the street holding their hands, I think, when I see the garbage truck coming along, I think, oh, well, you know, if this hits us, God, I hope it just hits me. You know, and there's very little fear attached to that. It's just that, you know, if you're going to hit someone, please hit me. And that's new, you know. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that it was just, you know, self-regard was the only thing on my mind. You know, I hope I don't die. So I wanted to capture that. I had to go there. I had to have David motivated by emotion, by love for his daughter, as well as be kind of muddled, or at least have his perspective colored by grief, because he loses his daughter at the beginning of the story. He loses her to what, you know, is a presumed suicide, but he comes to believe it's in fact a kind of a demonic abduction, and everyone, of course, thinks he's crazy. So it was sort of that love and grief and that ancient, you know, sort of mythological quest to bring back the loved one who has passed on, bring them back from the underworld to the world of the living, which has been a concern from the Greeks on up. I wanted to sort of tap into that ancient yearning to not let death have its day.
Have people who are close to you, who know you well, who've read the book, do they see bits of you in the character of David Ullman?
Well, I think so. You know, they, you know, it is, I think all of the, you know, the narrators of my novels, I mean, they've all but one have been first-person narratives, and I think I just am inclined to go there because, I guess in a way, I am able to explore some aspect of myself. I mean, none of them are, strictly speaking, me, and certainly none of the books are autobiographical in terms of their events, but, I mean, working on a novel for 3 years at a length is, it's a great way to kind of save on therapy. You know, I mean, you work things out, and you surprise yourself. And a lot of the time, it's not till the book is done and someone else close to you reads it that it's only till then that you understand the insight that's being provided into yourself.
So one needn't have read Milton's Paradise Lost either to understand this book, right?
No. And that was very important to me, that I didn't want the book to be, you know, a lecture, but at the same time, I did want to provide enough background about Paradise Lost to make sense. You know, the story to a degree relies on Paradise Lost, and so I needed to just, you know, reveal enough or talk about it enough for it to make sense for someone who had never encountered Paradise Lost, without it being, you know, dull or academic. And I think it's interesting. Some readers so far have, you know, wished for more about that, you know, and others have said, you know, sort of, oh, those are the parts we're kind of dragged down. There's some people just want pure story, just pure velocity. So, you know, you're not going to please everyone. But I did, that was the balance I wanted to strike.
Would you like us to read it after we finish this book?
Oh, yeah. No, I think I'd be delighted if a reader were to come away and sort of say, you know what, I'm going to read next? I'm going to read Milton. I mean, that would be a wonderful fantasy to entertain. But, you know, hopefully it will be either that, they'll either read Milton or they'll read more Andrew Piper books.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when did you first read Paradise Lost?
I read it under duress and in great haste in university, you know, the night before an exam. Yeah, sort of a survey course exam, as I recall it, and it left very little impression on me, except for Satan himself, you know, Milton Satan, at any rate, and the way this figure is drawn as a complex and seductive and compelling and sympathetic character who, at the same time, you know, is openly intent on the destruction of humankind. In the way that he was drawn, I guess, emotionally, that I understood, particularly as a young man, I understood that sense of isolation, of being thrown out of the house, of being neither here nor there, that outsiderness that I think is a universal, I mean, I think everyone, even people on the inside, feel like they're on the outside. And that was, I think, Milton's genius, is his creation of a figure who is, of course, the villain of the piece, but he's the one you understand the most, and he's the one, when he's off stage, you can't wait for him to come back. That was my takeaway. And, of course, years later, when I started to think about The Demonologist and this idea of a man searching for a daughter who he believes has been taken by a demon, that was when I thought, oh, I want the other side. I want the demon to be similarly emotionally, sort of full-blooded. I didn't want a demon that was just, you know, sort of drooling and ghoulish and just out to cause trouble for the sake of causing trouble. I wanted that demon to have a personality and to be emotionally motivated just as the protagonist is.
Now, this book, from what I've read of it thus far, it's quite visual. When you and I have talked previously, we've talked about the work that you've done in adapting your books for the screen. Has that work influenced, say, your writing, not just for this book, but in general?
I think this, you know, the screenwriting that I've done, here and there, I don't think it's been an influence on the books. I think I've always been cinematically inclined when it comes to scene making. You know, I do see things, visually, and I do see many of the, you know, particularly the action or the scary scenes, I do see them as set pieces. I see them as this falling to this, falling into this, and ratcheting up, and in the way that, I'm sure a Hitchcock would view the development of a scene. And in fact, I think, you know, The Demonologist, even though it's, again, a horror story, I think, you know, in terms of the making of the scenes, it owes more to a Hitchcock, that kind of quiet and subtle tools of creating suspense, as opposed to the buckets of blood approach.
Let's talk about sort of the surrounding hoopla around the book. I mean, I understand in where you live in Toronto, you see billboards of the book all over the place. The book's gotten a lot of press. What does Quill and Quire mean when they talk about Andrew Piper's unabashedly commercial tendencies?
I guess they mean that I write stories that the novels are, you know, classifiable as commercial fiction, which doesn't cause me any discomfort. That's how I see them too. I hope that in itself is not a disqualifier for their being well written and thoughtful and insightful. I think for some, you know, reviewers or critics or commentators, though, there is a kind of a brain cramp when it comes to, you know, commercial fiction or plot-driven fiction, that it's like, okay, well, if it's that, then it can't also be, of interest or worth discussing beyond the superficial, etc. That there's kind of a block, and I think that's too bad. It's not a block that I have as a reader as well as a writer. But I think it is a block that's more prevalent in Canada than in, say, the United States or in the UK. I think it's just part of our kind of our growing pain, culturally speaking, that we're kind of we kind of think categorically, and if a certain sort of term pops up, we're like, we kind of feel tripped up. But no, it's unabashed because I'm not trying to, you know, sneak around it. It's commercial fiction. I want people to, it's primarily designed to keep you up late at night and to excite you and to have you moving those, turning the pages quickly. That's its primary intent.
Now, the first interview we did in 2008 was for The Killing Circle. You were in Vancouver at the time to promote the book, and I don't know if you remember this, but it was the morning of the Giller long list coming out, and facetiously in the interview you said that it would have been a better list had you been on it. Now, you're not someone in this country who makes prize lists and the sort here, yet you've had great commercial success around the world. You're noticed in Hollywood. What do you think your experience says about the literary scene here? I mean, I think you've already touched on it in the last answer you gave.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think, just speaking generally, you know, I've been on prize juries or grant juries, and I know how they work. I mean, it's not, I think people will sometimes over-read into the process that, you know, these people are deliberating and they have explicit strategic plans and they, you know, it's a game. It's generally sort of three people in a room just trying to work something out. So I just sort of start with that comment that I'm not a conspiracy theorist when it comes to these things. But I think, you know, when it comes to, you know, Canadian literary prizes, that there's a certain expectation that the books will reflect one certain aspect of, quote, quality writing, so that it's there's a certain understanding of what serious writing is in Canada that, generally speaking, excludes the comic, the commercial, even to an extent the contemporary, and prefers you know, the aesthetics of the historical, the moralistic, the quieter, and preferably, you know, sort of not too plot driven either, you know, sort of, so it's more about, you know, sort of more musings. And again, this is a broad generalization, but I think that, you know, I think that tends to be true. And I think, again, that's just because that's kind of the first step we took was sort of, you know, this is the way it is, and now we kind of have a brand, you know, a Canadian literary brand that has a certain flavor in it, and I think that's good. You know, it's good to build a brand, but the problem with that is that if we don't refresh the brand and broaden it, and then it simply becomes a reflex. It simply becomes a prejudice. And I think, I'm not speaking, this is, by the way, not a long kind of argument for my own books to be on the Giller shortlist, but rather for the culture as a whole, I think it would be healthy to not get stuck.
And so the expectations for this book, I mean, you're hoping it does well in this country, obviously, but as well in the United States too, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, I have, you know, boundless hopes for it, but I'm a realist too. I mean, you know, it's a crazy racket. I mean, you can't, I mean, there's been tremendous support for The Demonologist from my publisher and early readers, and I haven't experienced this degree of, you know, support in my career up till now, so I'm very pleased with that. But at the same time, I know that that doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, in every territory it's published, it'll be some kind of earth-shattering success. You know, my wish for myself career-wise is maintenance. I just want to be able to keep doing this, and so I hope it's a sufficient success to allow me to do that.
Now, you're on Twitter a lot. We've conversed before on there. Has social media contributed to the writing process? Is it a distraction, as I assume it would be?
I haven't sort of seen it in that way. You know, I turned myself on, in terms of Facebook, I turned myself from a person into a page. So I now have an author page, which is more sort of business-like, and I sort of post things that are relevant to the books and the work. And I find that much less distracting, actually, because now I don't, you know, kind of find myself wasting an hour and a half, you know, looking at people's cats. Whereas,
food.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, like, what are you having for lunch?
Yeah.
I find Twitter much more, I find Twitter actually very useful. I get a lot of my news from Twitter. I learn a lot about whether it's industry things as well as personal things as well as political things on Twitter. I'm a real convert. I think Twitter is, I have no idea whether it, you know, sells books, but I find it a very useful news gathering device.
And you hear from readers too, don't you?
You do to a degree, yeah. There is interaction, and undoubtedly there is promotion too, self-promotion. But, you know, I think as a way, again, of kind of feeling like you are a part of a community, you know, that the, you know, what's the gossip, what's the talk, can, whether it's among writers, Torontonians in my case, or Canadians generally, you know, there's a, I find Twitter a really, we talk about community building on social media all the time, blah, blah, blah. I've never been convinced until this past year when I've gotten more involved in Twitter.
Well, when you were on last, I asked you what the next book was going to be about, and you described this book, sort of, and I suggested to you that Angels and Demons would make a good title for it. Were you working on the next book now?
Starting. So it's early days because, I mean, I have sort of an outline, and I'm working with my editor on sort of, you know, refining it. But yeah, I hope, you know, when the dust, the, you know, this initial publication week dust settles on The Demonologist, I'm hoping to get started.
Yeah, and it'll be in the horror genre as well, or?
It'll be scary. It'll be scary as well. I guess, yeah, I guess it will be horror, you know. But again, a kind of, you know, Andrew Piper way of horror. That is, you know, it'll be on the you know, sort of the tasteful, non-gore end of the spectrum. But it'll, you know, it'll take, well, you know, the idea is that it will take you to a place that, you know, when you close the book, you'll, you know, that night of sleep will be difficult.
Yeah. Andrew, you're one of my favorite guests because you're great to talk to, but as you know, The Guardians got me through a tough time in my life, so I'm forever a fan. Thanks for this, and continued good luck with this book.
Thanks so much, Joe. Cheers.
The book is called The Demonologist. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's author Andrew Piper on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.